From Milwaukee, welcome to the Phi Effect Podcast, where any film is open for discussion. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Matthew Baltz,
Jason Callen,
and Jacob Moradi.
Today, we're going to discuss last week's theme of a town torn apart by conflict, inspired by our review of Jimmy's Hall. But first, we're going to be reviewing Mistress America by Noah Baumbach.
Hi, this is Tracy Fishko. I go to a college in the city, and my mom said I should call you. My mom is marrying your dad.
Do you want to hang out? Do you know where Times Square is?
Tracy!
Times Square is so crazy.
Isn't it?
I don't know anyone who lives here.
Yours truly. I got off the bus from Jersey. I thought this was the cool place to live. It's Times Square.
So stylish.
I know. I freelance as an interior decorator. You know the Bowery Hotel?
Oh my God, yeah.
Well, if you walk about a block south, there's a laser hair removal center that's very hip. I did the waiting room.
Mistress America stars Greta Gerwig, Lola Kirk, and Matthew Shear, and follows Tracy as a struggling college freshman who finds excitement and adventure in her soon-to-be stepsister Brooke, played by Greta Gerwig. The first thing I'm going to say is that Noah Baumbach has a nice steady stream of movies behind him. Just this year, he came out with two, which was While We're Young and Mistress America, so he's right on the heels of Woody Allen. His career started in 95 with Kicking and Screaming. I'm just going to run through these because there are quite a few of them. His career started with Kicking and Screaming, Mr. Jealousy, Highball, The Squid and the Whale, Margot at the Wedding, Greenberg, Frances Ha, While We're Young, and we are here talking about Mistress America. I'm going to comment on his entire filmography and say that I was really drawn to Kicking and Screaming. That was the first of his movies that I saw, so I was really engrossed by that one. And then as his career went on, I would actually say I found some of his movies a little less appealing than his prior ones. And now his current movies actually have me more interested again. I would actually classify Mistress America as somewhat of a combination of two different eras of his filmography. It seems like it has the witty banter of his earlier films, such as Kicking and Screaming.
You forgot to mention that he also wrote the screenplay for Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted.
He wrote it on his own?
Co-wrote it.
I don't think I forgot to mention
I didn't notice that.
Chose not to. You did.
That's well, if I'm going to start talking about writing credits, I should go ahead and say that Greta Gerwig collaborated with him on Mistress America.
Okay.
He also co-wrote my favorite Wes Anderson film.
Which one was that?
Life Aquatic.
That's my least favorite.
is that honestly your favorite?
Yes.
I don't know why people dislike that movie that
much. I love that movie.
I enjoy it.
Like, until his last one, I didn't like anything since then, really. All right, we're not talking about it.
From my perspective, I think Mistress America does two things. It combines two different aspects of his career, which I honestly enjoy the most. It has a type of witty banter that I saw in Kicking and Screaming, and it also has this type of social commentary from While We're Young, which seems to be something that he is adapting to a lot. Jacob, what were your initial thoughts on Mistress America?
Well, seeing as this is the first Noah Baumbach film I've ever seen, I don't really have much of a grasp of his style or filmography. Well, except the couple films that I've seen that he co-wrote with Wes Anderson. That being said, I did do like a little bit of research on him, and I remember reading something where they said he seems to have an affinity for writing about the East Coast elite. So that was a very prevalent observation that I had throughout the whole film, and I like how he kind of critiqued that kind of upper middle class culture a lot, and kind of showed at times how shallow it can be throughout this film, because we go through all these characters who are just kind of unhappy for no particular reason except that they want to feel this like sense of troubled being, like by having that they kind of harken back to some sort of nostalgic sense of bohemianness, if that's a word, and kind of quasi-intellectual point of view. And I like how it just kind of showed how that's ultimately kind of an empty and pointless exercise, because not only does it leave you with no personality, but it also leaves you with really no friends or any acquaintances. So I really, like, as I thought more about the film, I just really like how it was kind of very critical of those people. But at the same time, the film, this is probably one of the driest films I've seen, especially in terms of comedy, in quite a while. And I don't mind dry humor, especially because I've got a very strange taste in humor. I can't really pinpoint it myself. But I really didn't laugh throughout the whole film at all. And I know it is like a comedy drama, so maybe I shouldn't have been expecting to laugh. But I just found it very hard to place any interest in any of the characters, especially because it seemed like right when it was going to fully criticize a character, and then maybe they get some sort sense of like realization and then go through some sort of change, that really never happened, except for the main character played by Lola Kirk, which I felt was almost, for some reason, like she got a little too much of the blame for what happens in the film, but that's just me. So overall, I'm very conflicted about the film. I appreciate the commentary that Baumbach was trying to say, but I just didn't find it that it was done in a very entertaining way.
It almost feels like you're describing While We're Young, with your nostalgic bohemian lifestyle that you're describing it as, because that movie definitely is trying to encapsulate that generation, that lifestyle, whereas this one seemed more keenly looking at millennial startups and this type of self.
What I meant was like a nostalgic sense of kind of like 60s bohemianness, where it's just kind of, you know, transferring that to like this millennial era, you know, the 21st century, where, you know, there's all these people where they've all got something to say about everything, every little societal issue, every little philosophical quandary. They're doing pretty much anything just to get by, and maybe not even to get by, but just because they have nothing else to do, so they just decide to hold 10 jobs or something like that. And just that kind of sense of trying to make the most out of life by doing everything, but then at that same time, it didn't seem like they were fully experiencing everything that what they were doing had to offer, and that's why it felt empty, and that they were just doing it for no purpose except to say that they could.
Jason, I know you went into this film with a little less enthusiasm than the rest of us. What history do you have with Noah Baumbach?
Well, I've seen a few of his films, Kicking and Screaming a long time ago, Squid and the Whale, Greenberg, and Margot at the Wedding. I haven't seen While We're Young, but of the ones I have seen, I'm not a huge fan. I liked Squid and the Whale in parts, and I thought Stiller was really good in Greenberg, but I'm not a fan of Greta Gerwig's. So I was definitely not really excited to be seeing this. I even avoided watching Francis Ha. I thought about watching it before going to this. I thought, you know, if Gerwig annoys me and I watch that and then I'm already annoyed and I go to see this, then I'm not giving this the fair chance that it might deserve. So I actually avoided that. This kind of just falls right in line with the kind of blandness of my opinion of Baumbach. I didn't find it funny at all. I don't think I laughed. I might have chuckled once, maybe one chuckle. I didn't know whose story this was supposed to be. Like, it's really Tracy's story. It should be Tracy's story, but then Gerwig kind of takes it over. But it's not really about her either. It wants to be about this relationship between, you know, the art and the artist, with this kind of her narration and this transferring of her experience into a short story, but it's not really about that either. It's just it gets pulled everywhere, and it has to, these quirky scenes that feel really obligatory and they don't really seem right, and characters that you meet and like are just like a huge part of the story. You don't know anything. It felt like a rush job. Gerwig had a script. They had a script, and they were just like, "Hey, we have this time between, you know, finishing this one movie and doing something else. Why don't we try and shoot this in a couple of weeks?" I don't know. It had that feel of just rushed. Yeah.
I like what you said by you didn't know whose story it was, because that's what, now that you said that, that's kind of what I felt, because there was that one scene, I think it was like right after we meet Greta Gerwig's character, where they're at the bar and she meets the old school friend who just comes up and starts criticizing her, like, you know, you kind of ruined my life for a long time. And I was like, that was actually a really cool scene that really dragged me in. I was like, wow, are we actually going to have some kind of like comeuppance later in the film, like that she'd actually learn that, you know, she's not as great a person as she thinks she is? And that's what I was hoping for. And then it almost seemed like it was going to do that, but then it did switch to when they were at her ex-boyfriend's house, where then everybody kind of turned on Tracy. And we never really got that full conclusion with the critique of Gerwig's character. And yeah, that's kind of what I missed out on. And it was kind of amusing how during that scene, it was like they just went to Gerwig's character so quickly, because she and Mamie Claire were, you know, almost like enemies. And then the enemies have to join forces against this other person. It was kind of cute.
That, like, got a little wacky.
Wacky is a good word. I was going to use cartoony, like how mortal enemies would all of a sudden become
friends. Yeah, and it's not just those two. It's everybody in the room just kind of sides with each other, and it seems
tonally different from everything else you see up to that point.
Exactly. It's jarring, took a bit of a jarring way
to end the film, and it's like the last like 15, 20 minutes of the film.
Mm-hmm. Bringing up the confrontation between Greta Gerwig's Brooke character and her old schoolmate, up until that point, I was trying to figure out how Noah Baumbach was trying to portray these characters. And at that point, I understood that, yes, this is a character, this is a person, this is a generation that he is commenting on in a not so pleasant way. I've noticed he Noah Baumbach has become someone with a really keen eye on like modern lifestyles, both between this and While We're Young. One of the weak points, in addition to the wackiness of the ending, was the character of Tony. Not the character, but the actor. I think Matthew Scheer was a little bit miscast in this movie. I don't think he was a good fit for this role, and seeing that he hasn't been in many other performances, I think that vindicates my opinion.
I didn't really like his character or his girlfriend. Well, I guess I didn't really like anyone. But
no, every character in this movie, I thought about it, they all have ambition, but their ambition is for the wrong reasons.
That's a good way of pointing.
The character of Mamie Claire, she comes out and mentions that her husband has a lot of money and that she enjoys that aspect of it. She covers it up really well, but that slips out. Her husband, I forgot his name.
Dylan.
He seems to be a little more friendly with Brooke than he should be. He mentions that a little bit. Brooke herself, I don't think I need to comment on. And then Tracy, the entire movie, she seems to be struggling to figure out who she is. At the beginning, we see her struggling as is just to figure out what she's going to eat in the cafeteria. She picks up a cupcake, she puts it back, and then she meets Brooke. And Brooke kind of takes control of her ambitions from there on out. The whole time, though, Tracy does use Brooke's character to write a story to try and get into this writing group. However, towards the end, when she does finally get accepted into this writing group, she comes to realize that's not what she wants, and she goes off on her own and tries to start something of her own. I feel like her character might be the only one that somewhat finds their own path or somewhat redeems themselves. Maybe that's the wrong way of putting it.
See, that's the thing. I didn't think she needed to be redeemed in the first place. Okay, maybe her story was a little harsh towards Brooke, but it was like she wasn't completely tearing her apart. She, you know, completely changed names and stuff like that. People get inspired by, you know, people in their lives all the time, especially creative people, and that's how they create stories. So that's why I didn't get why everybody just turned against her immediately. Maybe if just Brooke's character had, that would have made sense. But the way everyone did, and it was so blatantly, that's why I couldn't really justify too much need for redemption on Tracy's part. I mean, sure, Tracy was kind of a stick in the mud who didn't really look at the bright side of anything in life. I don't know.
All right, so we were talking about redemption. I agree. I don't think Tracy needed any redeeming in this film. She's a young, bright college student trying to become a writer. Like, she's got her head together more than most college freshmen that I know. You know, she meets this, I don't even know how to describe it.
Socialite. Let's call her a
socialite. Where we'd be nice. Okay, we're the socialite.
Bohemian.
This, I don't know about bohemian, but
fake bohemian.
Pseudo-bohemian.
Yeah, this
quasi-intellectual.
Quasi-intellectual pseudo-bohemian socialite. That's a lot. This kind of just flake, really. The Gerwig's character is pretty unlikable in every way. And then this big confrontation, like, she's the whole movie, we're kind of like, we're with Tracy, like, I think, you know, pretty much has her point of view. And then this big confrontation where they all tell her that her, you know, her story isn't good, and they all back Brooke. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it was disappointing to see, like, that moment where, like, she doesn't get to have ownership of that story anymore. Like, she has to listen to these people tear it apart for no reason, because it's what artists do. You know, she, you know, what is the Gerwig's character's name? I can't, Brooke. All of a sudden I forgot it. Brooke, I mean, she knows who Tracy is, that she's a writer, that she's been trying to write these stories. Like, what does she expect? It's just a really awful reaction. And it's a total flip for the movie. And it doesn't make any sense to me why all of a sudden we're meant to vilify her because of what she's been doing with her experience with Brooke.
This really makes me wish that one of you had seen While We Were Young, because it almost follows the same type of structure towards the end. The entire film, it follows Ben Stiller trying to make a documentary, and there's a lot of commentary and themes about truth and truth in documentary. And towards the end, it delivers a same type of heavy-handedness towards that subject, kind of breaking off of the entire style from the rest of the film. And so I wish there were a way to discuss that and almost try and find out what Noah Baumbach was attempting to do with both of those instances.
Like, he's trying to have a bigger discussion about the nature of truth in art, or
not only a discussion, but I think he's trying to offer an answer to that discussion for both of these movies.
Well, that might be his first mistake, trying to answer that question.
He tries to address a lot of interesting issues.
I wouldn't say so much issues as just kind of a culture as a whole. Because this doesn't feel like, I mean, I guess it feels timely because of, just like you mentioned, he's trying to criticize a generation of people. But I wouldn't say there's really any issues here, or at least like pressing issues that he's trying to criticize. I mean, unless shallow New Yorkers who think they're hot shit is a pressing issue, then yes.
I wish I could find some sort of deeper context behind the fact that Tracy is critiquing Brooke through her story, all the while Noah Baumbach is critiquing all of these people in this generation through his movie.
I don't know if Tracy's really even critiquing Brooke necessarily. She's just kind of commenting on her experience, you know, being with this person.
Yeah, because
Go ahead, Jacob.
I was going to say, in a way, like, even though she's critiquing her, and she still, like, almost wants to be her, because she just almost finds excuses, or after a while, she maybe not finds excuses, but just allows Brooke to just have her around all the time, or allows Brooke to, I don't want to say use her, but just, you know, let her run errands for her and stuff like
that's,
that.
That's a good point. Does she truly admire her and almost strive to be more like her? I can answer that in the best way with the imagery of this toy plane that she steals from Brooke's, I don't know if it's an apartment, but her...
It's a zoning commercial.
She steals this toy plane from Brooke's zoning commercial and seems to keep it as a keepsake.
She steals a lot of things.
She steals a lot of things. She does it in the best interest, I think.
She's a klepto.
I think she does it because she's a klepto. Most people do that to, you know, remember a moment or whatever. Except for the weed, you do that. I guess she stole that to forget a moment.
She does it with admirable intent. Why else would we see it later on when she puts it on her shelf? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but
Film School 101
would tell me that it is symbolizing some sort of lifestyle that she misses, or some life that she
misses. I didn't
even
notice that she put it back, quite honestly.
Oh, no, she put it on her shelf in her
Oh, Tracy put it?
Yeah, in her dorm.
Yeah, I think she definitely admires Brooke in a way, which is, again, it's like why this people are so surprised at this, you know, this disconnect between the writing and, like, what Tracy, you know, how she actually behaves. Like, she's spending all this time with Brooke. She likes Brooke. She's not, like, writing, you know, a hate piece on Brooke. She's just pointing out Brooke's ridiculousness, which is pretty obvious. And yeah, she, you know, she's not going to like it when she reads it herself, but tough luck. You involve yourself with a writer, with an artist. That's what they do. Reimagine your existence through their own perception. Rough life.
I mean, it could have easily been a hateful piece that
sure,
she wrote,
because she's pretty awful.
Yeah, especially because the movie paints Brooke in that way. Or at least suggests it.
Mm-hmm. But it does so while still having a moment or two of her, of depicting her as sympathetic.
Brooke.
There's certainly, you know, moments where the movie wants you to be sympathetic to Brooke. I don't know if it really succeeded in getting to a point where I actually was sympathetic for Brooke.
Exactly, because then that goes with the whole, like, twist in feeling for the ending, because it's just like right when she's about to kind of realize that maybe I should get my life together and actually have some sort of goal and some sort of point, maybe not just kind of bounce through life from one thing to another, bounce from people and treat people like I'm just moving them about.
I don't know if that ever crosses her mind.
Well, no, it's like right when she's about to realize that, that's when the whole reveal happens, where Tracy was writing a story on mm-hmm. her, and then everybody sides with Brooke instead.
Right, that should be the moment where she breaks down and is like, "Oh my God, this is how people see me."
Yeah,
I'm, because I can't believe it, like this person who I'm, you know, friends with, maybe, you know, kind of family with at that point, sees me like this. Oh wow,
and.
Let's go out and have a milkshake and hug it out.
Yeah, and she was kind of
trying to be a better human.
Yeah, she was realizing that, but then I think there was that point where she's like, okay, no, I won't accept the money. I'm actually going to do this all on my own. I don't need you guys. And then it's like, okay, she's actually learning to be like an adult in a way and just figure things out on her own.
Oh, I don't know. I think that was just because he destroyed her dream of like having the restaurant. I was like, what difference does it make now? Like, she can, you know, go into debt and not have the restaurant, or she can like succumb to this plan of like him bailing her out and not have the restaurant still. So I don't know. I don't think she got redeemed by the screenplay at all.
No.
Maybe she doesn't need it either. Maybe it's okay to be, you know, flighty, busybody.
I'm tempted to use the word like airheaded, but I'm not quite sure.
Accurate. We don't really have an idea of her, how successful she is, like, or is she successful? She manages to pay. Well, no, she doesn't even do that, because she gets, you know, locked out of her place. So mm-hmm. she's not even paying her rent. So I guess that's the one indicator that she can't get back into her place, that she's not successful, that these things, spin class ain't paying the bills, you know, these other endeavors that she talks about, you know, aren't really making her anything.
I think that goes back into like what I was saying earlier about how Baumbach's kind of critiquing this like upper middle class, but in a way how she wants to be a part of that, and how she's almost overcompensating for it, and by doing that she can't quite make it to that level, because she's constantly, you know, financially struggling. She doesn't really know how to act in a way, because she's just constantly going off on all these different tangents. So, I don't know.
She has, like, no inspiration, really. Only, like, ideas about what people expect of her, or what society expects of her, or whatever. Whereas, you know, Tracy is the opposite. Like, she's inspired by seemingly everything. Like, every motion that Brooke does, everything she says, like, is an inspiration to her.
Nice. I laughed. I laughed a lot.
Really? You laughed a lot?
Yeah.
I laughed a lot.
And bear in mind, I went into this movie with the same type of caution that I went to for Frances Ha or While We're Young. I did not expect to like this movie as much as I did.
Like I said, I feel like I gave it a fair chance, but I didn't, like I said earlier, I didn't laugh at all. Maybe I chuckled once or twice at the psychic.
He was amusing, man.
But it was just like, it was just another scene that just, I don't know, they all seem kind of perfunctory, like. You have to have the scene.
But
you
no,
have
I
have the scene.
I when you said burnt out, that's how I felt after the movie. Because even though the movie's really short, it's just going so fast, and mm-hmm. there's like hardly like a break in dialogue. There's hardly a break in scene.
Because Brooke never shuts up.
We need a break. Even like that first week of the semester, they just flew through that with the credits. Class does not go this fast.
Yeah, some of the dialogue worked for me. Some of it didn't. In the group banters when people are popping in and out of screen, saying one or two words and then popping back out. I liked what it was doing. I can't see that. That was probably when the film was really seeping into the wackiness that I ultimately am not a fan of.
Not in this moment, not in this movie, not for what it was prior to the wackiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't like that. Like I mentioned, how I thought the film felt very dry. These characters are not quite deadpan, but they're just so self-serious in a way. That kind of sense, I mean, maybe I can draw a parallel to Wes Anderson because Noah Baumbach's worked with him, and Wes Anderson's pretty, his character is pretty monotonous for most of the film and his style, and that's why I get a little tired of him, just because I personally can't tolerate that style for very long, and I felt like this film was almost a different iteration of that, where I needed something that was like more lighthearted or something that I could deal with, and I guess you could argue that Brooke tries to do that, but her character is just very irritating to begin with, so she's not good enough for me to distract me from the rest of these self-centered quasi-intellectuals.
I think that's the main problem is the Brooke character, because we're not, at least I wasn't ever sure, am I supposed to like this girl? Am I supposed to be laughing with her? Am I supposed to be laughing at her? I thought she was obnoxious. I thought it was, you know, nothing she said was funny. I just felt kind of bad for her, mm-hmm. really, after a while, because she just was kind of so ludicrous. And like so obviously just full throttle, because if she slows down for a second to reflect on anything, it's all just going to come apart. But the movie wants us to like her, I think. I mean, didn't you feel like it? I mean, she...
I don't know who the movie wants us to like, come to think of it. So, I mean, I don't know. Like I said, I did appreciate like the cultural critique that it offered. I just don't really like the way it was presented, I guess is the best way I can sum up this movie.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of a theme do you think we should do next week for this film?
Oh, boy. I know. I feel like we should do something about strong female characters, because I don't know if this really presented any. Like, I guess I did like Tracy up until to a certain point. I thought the movie was about her, and it was good when it was about her, but then they changed her character too, and it just became about none of them, and that was disappointing. But we don't have to go that way. That was just an idea.
Like something, so it's a good, vague topic that we can probably
not... know, movies that blow up in the third act and just become something totally different than what they had been.
That's a little more detailed.
Yeah, it is.
Movies that criticize a certain culture. It doesn't have to be like an elitist culture or anything like that. It could just be like some sort of counterculture or something like that.
I'd totally be down with strong female characters.
I'm down with whatever. I'm down with ideas. That too.
All right, it's done.
Even though there weren't that many in this film, but
well, maybe to highlight the need for stronger, especially considering like this movie will probably be noted for strong female characters, but it's not. They're not really that strong. That they're compromised.
All right. That said, let's move on to our episode theme. This is where every episode we choose a theme inspired by our previous review. Last time we talked about Jimmy's Hall, and we chose the theme of a township torn apart by conflict. So let's go ahead and start this episode theme off with Jason.
All right. This is a tough one. I went much lighter than Jimmy's Hall. I didn't go anything like historical or
you think yours is light.
It is Peter Hyams' 1982 science fiction film, Outland. And it's not necessarily a town in jeopardy. It's more like a colony or a... Not colony is good enough. But it is this basically an unofficial remake of High Noon, a Western from 54. I don't know, somewhere in the 50s. I don't have my device with me, so I can't...
You're fine.
I can't
cheat right now. You ballparked it.
Anyway, so 1982, Peter Hyams' remake, essentially, of High Noon. Where Sean Connery plays a sheriff on a mining colony who has to deal with the infiltration of a new drug that has been making people nuts. They either like go into airlocks and kill themselves, or they kill other people, or they take people hostage, and everyone, no one wants anything to do with them. The head of like the union, like the rep, is in on the importation of the drug. It makes the workers more efficient because it makes them sleep less, makes more production, and Connery is left completely without aid. Well, not completely, but I'll let you discover who actually helps him. Just a really solid sci-fi flick, decent production design for the time. Peter Hyams is kind of a, you know, underrated genre director in my opinion. You know, he writes, directs, photographs his own films. You know, pretty diverse and talented guy. And it also had my, just incidentally had my, it was one of my runners up for the best chase theme week that we had. So I almost used it for that.
Foot chase?
It is a foot chase, as a matter of fact.
We all had foot chases.
I noticed that. I was listening to it just today, and I was like, holy cow, we all chose foot chases. But it was another one, and it's right up there. It's got a great, great chase sequence through this betting. Can't think of the word I'm looking for.
Gambling?
No. It's like a huge complex where everyone sleeps. You know, it's like the, I'm trying to think of like
dorm.
Military dorm. Yeah, dorm is good enough, basically.
Barracks.
Barracks. That's what I'm, the word I was looking for. Although I don't know if that's necessarily accurate. But Outland, solid flick, my choice for Town in Jeopardy theme week.
The film I went with, slightly different than that, is...
good, that's what we want, right?
Yes. The 2012 film from Hungarian director Christian Mungiu, I think is how you pronounce his name, called Beyond the Hills. And this is where I mentioned before, it's not necessarily a town, but more or less like a covenant, kind of a... I think it's like an Eastern Orthodox... what's the word I'm looking for?
Monastery.
Monastery, yeah. Where, you know, it's this one priest and like all these nuns who work to run the place. And it's not, you know, just a church. They actually have, you know, domesticated animals there. So it's like a little community in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And one of the younger nuns, one of her friends from a previous orphanage from about 10 years past, shows up there. I don't remember if it's necessarily because she like just left the orphanage or because she finally had nowhere to go, so she goes to her one and only friend.
I think it is kind of a combination of both.
Okay. And it was hinted at that they had some sort of like intimate relationship in the past, and this girl who just showed up here really misses her friend, who's trying to be a more devout person and more religious. And the girl who showed up there, she kind of has a mental breakdown then, and the people try to treat her using just prayer and other forms of faith-based medicine and stuff like that, and none of it's working, and her condition gets worse and worse to the point where she's inflicting like lots of self-abuse on her, and her friend who's the nun is very conflicted. Then does she try to stick up for her friend and do something against what the priest and all the elder nuns are doing, or does she stay devout and become a good nun in the community?
I have seen that movie. The difficult part was that this community does try everything they can to not only help her but rid themselves of her. But she just won't leave. She won't calm down. And you find yourself kind of debating, well, what else could they have done? Mm-hmm.
It's a very intense film.
Well, I'm glad that somebody did choose a more dramatic film, because mine is not so much dramatic at all. I sold out because this movie was going to wind up on a theme at some point. I could have easily gone with some Holocaust film about a town that is being Aryanized by the Nazis, or I could choose a documentary about a town conflicted between its coal miners and social groups and whatnot. No, I went with Jason Eisner's 2011 film Hobo with a Shotgun. Because I do enjoy this movie. And to be honest, if there's any type of film that depicts a town torn apart, this is it. This is retro chaos at its best. The film, if I even need to describe it, is about a man who comes into a town and attempts to clean up all of the corruption, all of the crime. And there is a lot of crime. There is the mafia. There is corrupt police forces. There's even one or two otherworldly bounty hunters. And so heads explode, and it's the best thing that you will ever see, as long as you can enjoy black comedy.
I have yet to see that. It's been on my list a long time because I'm a big fan of Rucker Hauer. So
it's on my shelf.
I got.
I'd love to see it.
I got dragged along to that by a high school friend, like right before we went off to college, because a theater in my town was showing a double feature of this and A Clockwork Orange. Okay, it wasn't a double feature, but it was like a strange feature. They weren't showing any new films. They just showed that and this film. So we made a double feature out of it.
Weird.
And it was a very interesting double feature. And I like both of the films very much. Oh, man. What a great film. And not just any man comes to save the town. It's Rutger Hauer.
Rutger Hauer and Malcolm McDowell back to back. A match made in heaven.
Sounds like quite a nice afternoon.
All right, well, that's going to conclude today's review of Mistress America. If you're in the Milwaukee area, the local Oriental Theater, part of Landmark Theaters, is currently showing Mistress America. You are listening to Matthew Baltz,
Jason Callum,
and Jake Meridian.
This is the Phi Effect Podcast. Thank you for listening.